From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Forecasters are warning that the dangers of Tropical Depression Alberto are not over as the storm continues to dump heavy rain across parts of the south. Alberto came ashore as a subtropical storm yesterday in the Florida Panhandle, dumping between 2 to 5 inches of rain there. The storm also battered the Carolinas, where a TV news anchor and a photojournalist from WYFF in Greenville, South Carolina, were killed after a tree toppled onto their SUV. Joining us now is Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, it's good to have you back. And first of all, tell us, where are the remnants of the storm and where is it headed?
Oh, good afternoon, Megan. The storm is, or the remnants of the storm are moving into northern Alabama, but that's just the center of what's left of its circulation. As you mentioned at the top here, the effects of this do spread out quite a bit across the southeast. So there's a very large moisture pool with this system, a lot of energy kind of spread across many, many states. And even here in Florida, we're still going to see some lingering effects from this. So it's going to drift into the Tennessee Valley and kind of drift in a northwestward direction, almost toward Missouri and Illinois. And then it's going to move to the north and east toward the end of the week, get pulled up by a cold front sweeping across New England, and then eventually, it will move out into the mid-Atlantic states by this weekend.
I see. So you mentioned a lot of moisture in this storm. I mean, what are the primary hazards people still need to watch out for?
It's literally that, flash flooding from the heavy rain that will occur. Remember, when a storm originates in the tropics, its rainfall rates are typically much higher than the thunderstorms that might develop over land in the summertime. So, and by the way, sometimes the episodes last a lot longer. You have these bands that kind of light up in the same areas for several hours. So it's almost impossible to predict exactly where the next flash flood event may occur, but in a large area, there is at least that enhanced risk. Today, the risk is highest over Kentucky, southern Illinois and Indiana, parts of Alabama and Georgia. Tomorrow, the risk spreads across the Appalachians. And unfortunately, in Maryland, where we had the flash flooding event over the weekend, there is a risk for that occurring again Friday and Friday night in some of those same areas.
Okay. Well, so lots of states still need to keep their eyes on the forecast, as you're saying. But Alberto wasn't as much of a big deal for most of Florida as had originally been expected. Do we know why that is?
Yeah, well, it's kind of the way you look at it or the way you approach the storm is very important to your perspective afterwards. Mm-hmm. We, of course, were highlighting the possibility of certain hazards taking place, including the very heavy rain and possible flooding. That did not pan out in a widespread nature across the state, primarily because of the orientation of the wind direction. The storm was kind of moving in a north-northwest direction, and so the wind flow ended up pulling in some drier air for the duration of the event. So much of the state didn't see the anticipated rainfall amounts. But still, the Panhandle saw some significant rain. It came in a little weaker than projections. But you have to remember, these situations can fluctuate quickly over time. One of the most challenging things with tropical weather systems is not really where they make landfall. It's the intensity when they come ashore.
Yeah.
And it was the direction of the wind that kind of cut down on the rain across Florida.
Right. Well, we just got a minute to go here. Alberto is the first named storm of the 2018 Atlantic hurricane season. Any sense as to how Alberto gives us, does it give us a window into what the season might be like?
Well, typically, and I get asked that all the time when there's preseason activity, and we seem to have had a lot of that in the last few years, but typically an early season event like this does not really foretell what may happen the rest of the year. It does not strongly correlate to an active or a below normal season. The forecast generally and the signs do point to a near or slightly above normal season, as NOAA announced last week. Several other private forecasters are saying similar things. We have conflicting signals, Magna, this year. The central Atlantic, where most of the storms develop, we may not see as much activity there, but that doesn't mean something couldn't form closer to home in the Caribbean or the Gulf of Mexico. So as we always say, let's prepare the same every year.
Well, Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, a major U.S. marijuana company is going public today in Canada. California-based MedMen is valued at nearly $1.7 billion on the Canadian Securities Exchange. The company is trying to raise money abroad because it's still difficult to attract investors here in the United States. And Canada is turning out to be fertile ground for the global marijuana business. Here Now's Peter O'Dowd has been looking into this. He joins us now. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Jeremy.
So MedMen does business in California, in New York, in Nevada. Why are they going public in Canada?
Basically because they don't have a lot of other options. So MedMen is a pretty well-known brand in the United States. They grow marijuana. They manufacture things out of the plant like oils and extracts, and then they sell it in these fancy retail stores. But as you can imagine, federal law here in the U.S. makes it very hard for them to raise cash, which is not the case in Canada, because in Canada, they legalized medical marijuana back in the early 2000s. And so MedMen's Daniel Yee, who I spoke to recently, told me they've got to go north in order to keep their business growing.
For us, what it will do is it will allow us to get that capital much faster, because I'll be honest with you, we have a lot more projects. We have so many projects in the pipeline. And what determines our pace of growth is capital.
And Jeremy, that capital is expected to flow a lot more when adult recreational use is fully legalized in Canada, and that is expected to happen later this year.
But I imagine that MedMen is not the only American company looking for investors in Canada. What kind of competition are they going to have?
They're going to have a lot. There are a handful of stock exchanges in Canada, but the CSE, where MedMen is listing, is known as sort of like this happy home for marijuana firms. I had a conversation with a spokesman there who told me that the CSE has about 28 listed cannabis companies that have U.S. assets or some connection to the United States. And then if you look at the pipeline of the companies about to go public or companies with plans to go public on the CSE, there are another 15 to 20 more. Mm. Now, if you look at all the cannabis companies on the CSE, more than half of them went public in just the last 2 years or so. So there's a major rush going on.
But the Canadian Securities Exchange is relatively small if you compare it to the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, which American companies like MedMen would probably love to get access
to. There's no doubt that they would. And here's the irony. Canadian companies are allowed to list on those American exchanges, and it's just starting to happen. There's a company out of Toronto called Cronos that was the first pure-play marijuana firm to list in the U.S. this spring. And then just last week, a similar company out of Ontario called Canopy went public on the New York Stock Exchange. It happened just a few days after I spoke with MedMen's Daniel Yee, and he was well aware of these different rules that his American company has to play by.
That's the complexity of being in the cannabis industry today. You know, we would like nothing more than to list in the New York Stock Exchange or on the NASDAQ, as have Canadian companies. As you know, Cronos Group has listed on NASDAQ, and Canopy Growth will list on the New York Stock Exchange. These are two Canadian marijuana companies that do essentially the same thing that MedMen does here in the U.S. NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange will list them. They will not list MedMen.
Because you're an American company.
Because we're an American company.
And under American law, you can't be doing this business.
Yes. So it is because it's federally illegal here in the U.S. that the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange won't take us. But it's because of their fiduciary duty or, you know, from their perception, the level of risk that it would be for investors. But we don't have that option available to us today. And that's why we're listing on the Canadian Securities Exchange.
So NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange tell me that if a company is following the rules and the laws of its home country, it is eligible to list. So Canada's in, the U.S. is out.
I have a feeling that some of these American companies are probably just going to move to Canada so that they can do what they want and list in the United States. This gives a real competitive advantage to Canada.
A huge advantage. And they already had an advantage because they've had years to perfect growing their plants, the manufacturing process, the distribution and export around the world. And so now you're seeing all this attention paid to Canada. You've got big American alcohol and tobacco companies making investments in these Canadian pot firms because they see an opening. You've got MedMen, who's just recently made a deal with Cronos to open retail stores in Canada once adult recreational use becomes legal. And the president of an American cannabis investment firm, Chris Crane, told me that it's American law that's essentially making Canada ground zero for this boom.
We are literally giving the next multi-billion dollar industry, you know, the next internet boom to the Canadians.
The next internet boom, which makes you wonder whether we're talking here about something that is risky, something that there's a lot of speculation involved.
Yeah, there are analysts who say that a day of reckoning is coming because you have all these relatively new companies going public. They don't have a huge track record of making a lot of revenue, and yet they're valued at over $1 billion. And so some of these companies could do well, but there is a danger that they are overpriced, and people are warning that there could be a wave of consolidations coming that will wipe out some of those smaller companies that were built on speculation. The other thing is that Canada's advantage could go away. I mean, generally speaking, Canada's market is tiny. It's about the same size is the entire state of California. So they know that they have to go beyond their borders in order to really stay on the front end of this wave, because if America ever catches up from a regulatory standpoint, it's going to dwarf Canada.
That's Here Now's Peter O'Dowd. And Peter, you're heading to Canada for more reporting on this.
Yeah, I'm going to go up to see the headquarters of Canopy. They're in Smiths Falls, Ontario, about an hour outside of Ottawa. They've taken over an old Hershey's chocolate factory that shut down several years ago when the jobs in that chocolate factory went to Mexico. So this is sort of a new business cropping up in a town that was hurt by globalization. So there's a lot going on.
And if they want to put the marijuana in the chocolate, it's right there in the factory. Here Now is Peter O'Dowd. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Today, students are returning to Santa Fe High School in Texas for the first time since the mass shooting there less than 2 weeks ago. This is the last week of the school year. Supporters from the community lined the side of the road by the school this morning, holding Santa Fe Strong signs in green and gold. Those are the school's colors. Tammy Withers was among them. She's the parent of a Santa Fe High School senior. She spoke with Fox 26 Houston.
They shouldn't have to worry every day, you know, what's going to happen. You know, they shouldn't say, Mom, I don't want to go to school today. And you're like, no, you need your education. You have to go. And then if something happens, that's crazy. That is, it's a human issue. It's a people issue. It's not a gun issue.
Kennedy Morgan was also there to welcome students back this morning. She's a senior at Kingwood High School and drove an hour to show her support. Here she is speaking with HLN.
You know, it's kind of just cool to be here and to let these kids know that we're supporting them and they're not alone.
10 people were killed on May 18th, including Cynthia Tisdale. She was a substitute teacher at Santa Fe High and had been teaching an art class when the shooting began. Her husband, W.R. Tisdale, is on the line with us now. And W.R., thank you for taking a few minutes for us. And of course, our condolences. This must be a very hard time for your family.
Yeah. It's been the most difficult time of my life. I never, ever expected to lose my wife. We, the night before she was shot, we were making funeral arrangements for me because I've got this lung disease, and it's just one of those things you never, ever thank your wife or anyone you know is going to be shot and killed the way she was.
When you mentioned your lung disease, this is idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Right.
Yes.
And your wife was trying to raise money for you before she died.
Correct.
I know that ever since she passed away and more attention has been brought, you've raised a lot of money.
Yes, and I'm going to go someday this week call the Lung Institute in Dallas and get the procedure started where they take stem cells out of my bone or my body and take the old ones out. They go through a process where they only use the new ones. And then I go back the next day and they inject them into my body. I've been told it works and I've been told it doesn't work. But I do know if I don't at least try it, I probably may make it through the end of the year, and that's about it. So to me, it's, you know, it's worth a try. I mean, I can't lose.
What do you think Cynthia would be telling you to do right now about this?
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Let me grab myself together. She would be setting an appointment for me and even driving me up there. She was the one that took care of me and cared for me, babied me for almost 47 years. Also, the night before this happened, I was extremely ill. And she came home from school and looked at me and said, "You don't look well." I said, "Well, honey, I've had a terrible day. Did you eat?" And I said, "No, I didn't. I don't feel like eating." So she opened a can of soup, chicken noodle, warmed it, sat on the floor by my chair, and spoon-fed me, and made me eat. When I said I was full, she said, "No, you're not." And she made me eat near that whole can. She was exceptionally good to me. Almost 47 years.
Well, and she left you a note that morning, right?
Yeah, she did. I'll read it to you. My niece is wanting to get it. And she wrote me a lot of notes about things. And I never saved them. I wish I would have. This one. She said I had to go meet a teacher. And I assume that's the other teacher that got killed. I love you. Hope you feel better today. Love, Mom. And I left you breakfast. And so I just left it open in the bathroom. And when I went into the kitchen, there was my breakfast. I guess by then she had already been shot, but we didn't. They called me about it. It just became a blur that day.
Yeah.
Until my son, Reese Jr., came over that night and told me. And we buried her Friday. 1 week before her birthday, she was killed, and we buried her on her birthday. And when Mother's Day was here, my daughter took me out and went into a local store that sells cards, and she came out and got me where I could ride the card in. And I bought her a Mother's Day, and I went on and bought her a birthday card while I was there. I never knew that was the last one. We were going to buy an anniversary card because I don't know if I'm going to be here in September. That would have been 47 years. I told my daughter, I said, "Look, I want her to buy her a 50th wedding anniversary card, too. Because I know unless something changes, I won't be here." And I asked my daughter to give it to her. And now that won't happen. But people have been more good to me. I've had an outpouring of love and encouragement from people.
When you've got your niece there with you, it sounds like your family is there with you now.
Yeah, my niece is a ex-Marine, and she lives in South Texas, but she's going to move up here and try and find a job here in the Houston area, and then just that way I got someone with me. At nighttime, I got grandkids and kids around me, but at nighttime, she'll be here. She's been a big help to me already.
There are a lot of people who are just hearing your story for the first time, just hearing about Cynthia for the first time. Okay. What would you want them to know? What message would you want to leave them with? People that you'll never meet, they'll never meet you in person, but what would you want them to know?
Well, she loved her husband, loved her grandkids, loved her children. I've got the daughter I mentioned got flooded during Harvey, and she was working also to help fix her house up. So she was a lady that loved me, loved her family. And this loved people in general. I've had people walk up to me and tell me stories that she did for them. that I never knew. Hmm. And she never expected anything in return. She just was a good mother and a good Grammy. And for me, she took care of me. And I've had back surgery. I've had heart stents. I've had just about everything go wrong with me as I've gotten older. And she's been there when I had my back surgery. I didn't want someone bathing me. So she came up and would bathe me every night. Hmm. She was just that woman, you know, the one you read about that never gets any praise. But she should have been. I'll miss her. And many friends are going to miss her.
Well, she's getting some praise from you today, so that's good. W.R. Tisdale, husband of Cynthia Tisdale, substitute teacher who was killed in the shooting at Santa Fe High School on May the 18th. Our thoughts are with you and your family, and thank you so much for joining us and remembering Cynthia with us.
I sure appreciate the opportunity to say something good about it. Thank you so much.
I'm sure it's very, very, very difficult, and but it sounds like you're at least remembering all the good things about Cynthia, so that's good too.
Yeah, God has a way of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's done it for me.
Yeah. We've got a link to WR's GoFundMe page for his lung stem cell treatment at our website, hereandnow.org.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Usually, shared bikes have docking stations, but since last fall, thousands of dockless shared bikes and scooters have appeared on the streets of Washington, D.C. Their fans say they could revolutionize urban transportation. Foes see them as an unsightly intrusion on sidewalks. Jacob Fenston of WAMU has more.
It's the middle of the morning commute in D.C.'s Columbia Heights neighborhood. A few months ago, Michelle Bassalette would likely have been crowding onto the subway escalator.
If I were to take the metro, it'd be probably like a 45-minute commute.
In a pinch, she'd take an Uber or drive.
If I take the car in the morning, I have to allot like 35 minutes.
Now, though, she rides a bike. She prefers the bright red electric assist jump bikes if there's one available. It cuts her trip to 10 minutes. The GPS-enabled dockless bikes and scooters are easy to find and unlock using smartphone apps. A few blocks away, Megan Anand is unlocking an electric scooter for her commute.
I like to bike to work, but sometimes that's outfit restrictive. This is much easier. You can wear a dress, you can wear a skirt.
Plus, she says, it's way more fun than being stuck in traffic or on a crowded bus.
I mean, you feel like you're 4 or 5 years old again riding a scooter in your neighborhood. I'm sure I look pretty stupid, but it is fun.
Since September, thousands of people in D.C. have been trying out new ways of getting where they need to go. Grown-ups commuting to their grown-up jobs on scooters. And people who don't even own bikes, let alone Lycra bike shorts or a messenger bag, are biking to work. The dockless bike companies say they've collectively logged more than 300,000 rides by more than 125,000 riders so far. But just as quickly as people have been hopping on these bikes and scooters, they've sparked a whole range of complaints.
It's pissing a lot of people off.
David Nelson says he frequently sees dockless bikes parked right in the middle of the sidewalk or in the curb cut. For most people, that's an annoyance. They can walk around, but he's in a wheelchair.
If it's in my way and I can't get around it, I'm just going to knock it over because I can't move it.
Others complain the cheaply made bikes, easily stolen, have become trash, littering the city. Katie Kane is with Rock Creek Conservancy, which recently held a big creek cleanup. Along with the usual plastic bottles and coffee cups, there was something new this year.
We found 5 bikes in the physical creek and 1 scooter, as well as a couple of bikes sort of sporadically dumped in the area.
Kane says her group is in favor of dockless bikes and biking in general.
We are just against people leaving dockless bikes in the creek.
These are the same complaints that have popped up in other cities experimenting with dockless bikes and scooters. In Dallas, there's been an anti-bike backlash, and San Francisco is in the grips of a scooter war with city workers rounding them up and impounding them.
You can't stymie innovation. It'll just pop up somewhere else.
Gabe Klein used to run the D.C. Department of Transportation, where he helped launch the region's docked bike system, Capital Bike Share. It recently celebrated its 20 millionth ride. In the 8 years since it launched, the share of people cycling in D.C. has nearly quintupled to about 5%. Now, Klein says, dockless shared bikes could spark a similarly profound change, especially the electric ones.
When you get on one of these electric bikes, you're like, wait a second, like, this is so easy, and it's faster, and it's fun, I'm getting exercise, and I'm happier. You realize, like, the future is the bicycle.
In the future, it may not just be dockless bikes and scooters. People ask Klein about this all the time.
They're like, well, Gabe, what do you think the next thing is? And I'm like, definitely hover shoes. But I don't know if people are going to share them. So there may not be a business in that.
For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Fenston.
The top nuclear negotiator for North Korea is on his way to New York to meet with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about the on-again, off-again, on-again summit with President Trump next month. Now, a visit by such a high-level North Korean is unusual, as is the visitor. Kim Jong-chol is the former spy chief of North Korea, and South Korea blames him for masterminding the 2010 sinking of a South Korean Navy ship. He's also overseen the expansion of North Korea's cyber warfare capabilities, including the cyber hacking of Sony Pictures in 2014. So let's find out more about him from Jean Lee, director of the Korea Studies Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's the former North Korea bureau chief for the Associated Press. Jean, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. So first of all, broadly, what does this visit by Kim Jong-chol signify?
Well, this is the strongest sign so far that plans and preparations to get the summit back on track for June 12th are in place. I mean, we now have this high-ranking, very senior North Korean official heading to the United States. It's the highest-ranking official we've had here in 18 years. So that's a strong sign that Kim Jong-un is serious. And he is sending his personal envoy, the man who has been at his side at all of the summits over the past couple months. And so he will be here to deliver his message personally and I think undertake some tough negotiations with Secretary of State Pompeo.
So Kim Jong-chol was very close to the current North Korean leader's father, Kim Jong-il. What's his relationship like with Kim Jong-un?
He is one of the few people who's made the transition from the Kim Jong-il era to the Kim Jong-un era. So clearly a trusted Kim family associate. And somebody that Kim Jong-un has relied on as well. Now, I don't know exactly how much he relies on him for strategy, but if he is indeed the spymaster who orchestrated or came up with some of these plots to sink that South Korean warship in 2010 and to carry out that cyber attack that really disabled Sony a couple years ago, then he is a master strategist who's been whispering in Kim Jong-un's ear in giving him some tips on how to get the attention of the South Koreans and the Americans.
Well, so correct me if I'm wrong, but he went to South Korea as the North's envoy during the Winter Olympics, right?
Indeed, he was there at Pyeongchang, so that was a very high-profile appearance for him as well. Now, we should point out that not only was he a former spy master, but he is currently the official on the Central Committee of the Workers' Party who is in charge of inter-Korean relations. Mm. And so it makes perfect sense that he was that official representing Kim Jong-un at those
right.
Winter Olympics.
But he's obviously very, very controversial in South Korea, right? We talked about the sinking of the South Korean Navy ship, for example, and family members of the sailors who died protested his presence in South Korea during the Winter Games. So, I mean, does his trip to the United States potentially, what effect might that have on U.S.-South Korea relations?
You're absolutely right. Conservatives in South Korea are going to be up in arms if this man is given the kind of legitimacy that this kind of meeting with Secretary Pompeo lends him. But that said, they also understand that he is the guy who has Kim Jong-un's ear. He is the guy who can convey Kim Jong-un's desires. And so if they want any movement on the summit, if they want any movement on in terms of peace on the Korean Peninsula, that he's the guy that they're going to have to talk to.
Mm. Now, we just got a minute to go here. There's a lot of diplomatic activity around this issue going on right now. That surprise meeting of both Korean leaders on Saturday, this meeting coming up here in the United States. I mean, what's your sense about this moment right now, and are these efforts going to be productive?
It's a very strong sign, a very good sign that they have their top people, very knowledgeable and experienced people. Kim Jong-chol obviously has been dealing with the Americans and dealing with these issues for many years. We have a team from the United States that is extremely experienced in dealing with the North Koreans as well, and that is absolutely reassuring for me. But let's just be clear that what they're going to discuss is going to be difficult. Mm. These are just the fact that their meeting is positive, but they've got some tough discussions ahead. Mm. And whether they can get on the same page to clarify what they're going to discuss at that summit mm-hmm. and what they're going to agree to remains to be seen. So we'll have to watch to see what happens in the next couple days.
Well, Jean Lee is director of the Korea Studies Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Jean, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, back to news here in the United States. There are now well over 1,000 colleges and universities that don't require the SAT or ACT scores in deciding who to admit. And that number is growing every year. According to a new major study, test scores are of so little value in predicting student performance in college, maybe they shouldn't be required at all. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The study's key finding is this. Colleges that don't require SAT and ACT scores enroll and graduate a higher proportion of low-income and first-generation students and more racial and ethnic minorities. Students who don't submit their test scores often outperform those who do.
Absolutely.
Steve Syverson is an assistant vice chancellor at the University of Washington, Basel, and co-author of the study.
When a college considers going test optional, one of the first reactions that people, including alumni, feel is that the college will be admitting less qualified students. But our research clearly demonstrates that these students graduate often at a higher rate than the submitters.
And that is a big deal, says Iverson. He and his fellow researchers from Bates College closely studied 28 public and private institutions that no longer require test scores and tracked about 956,000 individual student records. Students like Ian Hamowitz, a sophomore at George Washington University, a test-optional school in Washington, D.C.
I know for a fact I'm the first Nicaraguan-American, the first Jewish Latino that they meet.
When Ian arrived at GW, he says he looked around and asked himself, what am I doing here with kids who went to private schools and got the best education possible? He says back in New Mexico, his high school sometimes didn't even have enough teachers.
I remember, my freshman year of high school, I didn't have a math teacher. We had a year-long substitute teacher. Maybe that's why you see on my test score that I didn't really have a good grounding in math.
Ian was a straight-A student in high school, but his SAT scores were so low, he didn't think any top-tier school would accept him. not having to submit his test scores opened the doors to a top selective school, no less. GW this year got 26,500 undergraduate applications from students all over the country. About 20% did not submit their test scores, which GW says has helped enroll more minorities. Still, some researchers question the impact that test optional policies have had on schools. Jack Buckley of the American Institute for Research says, sure, student diversity has improved at schools that stopped requiring test scores.
But it also increased at the same rate among those that didn't.
In other words, says Buckley, test optional schools are not any more effective in enrolling minorities than schools that still require test scores. Steve Cyrison says that's not what the evidence from his study suggests.
We certainly are not arguing that everyone should abolish test scores. Test scores do have some value.
But the research shows that tests can be an obstacle, not just for students who don't test well, says Cyrison, but for underserved, underrepresented minorities. His team's findings show you can admit pretty good students by looking at something other than test scores, and GW is a good example.
Our experience when they come to college is actually that their high school performance predicts their college performance extremely well.
Forrest Maltzman is GW's provost and chief academic officer.
Whatever worked for them in high school, that competitiveness spirit, that work ethic, tends to work for them in college. And the test isn't getting at this. I wanted to show you this chart. And
Maltzman pulls out several color-coded charts showing that students who got into GW with high test scores performed no better as freshmen and sophomores than those who got in without submitting their test scores.
And so the added value of test scores in predicting performance today is really very, very minimal. One of the best things that these tests match up with is actually family income.
And that, says Cyrison, is consistent with his team's findings. But he cautions, test optional policies are no panacea. They're just another way to make college more accessible.
If an institution wants to do a better job of serving traditionally underserved populations, test optional can provide a very useful tool.
Whether institutions use it or not, says Cyrison, depends on their commitment to that goal. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
The president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, will mark 2 years in office next month. He's led a violent crackdown on drugs that some critics say goes too far. Maria Sereno was one of those critics, and she was recently dismissed as the country's top Supreme Court justice. Duterte is also known for some rather undiplomatic and crude remarks. And a warning to listeners, some of that language is in this next conversation. Howard Johnson is the BBC's Philippines correspondent. He joined me from Manila, and I asked him if Duterte still has the kind of support that got him a landslide win in 2016.
Yeah, he still has huge popular support here, and that it really is because people feel that law and order has been brought to the Philippines, that they feel safer. This is lots of people I've been speaking to in taxis saying that they are less bag snatchings in the streets now. There's a perception that criminals are fearful of being killed by the police. Now, if you speak to the liberal elite here in Manila, they say that they are horrified by President Duterte. You hear a different story, that they don't like the sentiment of the president. He recently said something along the lines of any female insurgent should be shot in the vagina by the army. He's also rejected the International Criminal Court. And that's because, of course, the International Criminal Court are investigating or beginning a preliminary investigation into allegations of crimes against humanity because of this war on drugs that's going on in the country where thousands of people have been killed.
Well, we mentioned the Supreme Court judge that was ousted. You spoke to her and she talked about how Duterte had treated her. Let's listen.
In August of 2016, when he said, "You, Chief Justice, you want me to tell everybody not to follow you?" That is basically a weakening of democratic institutions.
Is there any doubt that she was ousted for political reasons?
Maria Sereno told me that she's absolutely certain that this is to do with politics. Her supporters say that this is because she's been a fierce critic of the president's war on drugs. She said all these allegations against her are hogwash. Now, it's worth going back over this one. The government's top lawyer brought around a petition against her saying that she had failed to declare statement of earnings before she was appointed as the country's top judge. At the same time, the House were looking at an impeachment process against her over corruption. And actually, in the last week or so, we're also seeing now that the Bureau of Internal Revenue are also looking into her records, her tax declarations as far back as 2004. So we can expect this story to roll on and on.
Howard, we've been talking about what's been going on in the Philippines. It's obviously in a very important part of the world, a lot of big international players very close by. And in fact, President Duterte is going to be visiting South Korea next month for a meeting with President Moon Jae-in. How is Duterte seen in the region?
Well, on the face of it, he's received warmly by leaders such as those in China and Japan, key countries for aid and infrastructure support. But if we take last November's ASEAN summit in Manila, we didn't see a single dissenting voice against the president's punitive war on drugs, for instance, you know, one where we've seen thousands of drug suspects killed by police and vigilantes. And that could be because a number of countries in this region have pretty bad human rights records, so it's best not to bring up these issues. But in the end, Justin Trudeau of Canada was the only leader who raised concern about the killings. President Duterte described his comments as a personal and official insult.
There's another name that many Americans probably know from boxing. That would be Manny Pacquiao. Turns out he's also a politician in the Philippines. How does he fit into all of this?
Yeah, Manny Pacquiao is actually training at the moment for a big title fight with Lucas Matisse, the Argentinian boxer. That's going to happen in June. This is a crucial career-saving fight for him because he lost his last fight to the Australian Jeff Horn. So I went along to General Santos to interview him. General Santos is his hometown. And I went along to meet him as he was juggling his career. He has to switch hats between being a senator and a boxer. And I saw him, you know, 1 minute doing ab crunches and then the next minute talking to constituents about issues, including the war on drugs. And he is very supportive of the president. He's good friends with the president. He openly admits that he supports the war on drugs. And during an interview with him, he told me that the world doesn't understand the president. He says that the president only told the police to kill in self-defense. It's not a shoot-to-kill policy. And so what we're seeing is this next fight for Manny Pacquiao is very important, not only to show him as a successful boxer and to retain that legacy, but also to see that he is someone who can deliver results as a politician as well.
That's the BBC's Howard Johnson joining us from Manila in the Philippines. Howard, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.